History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold if we're willing to engage, to ask a few questions, to take some time to listen. You never know just how much might be added to your perspective. The idea here has always been to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but we do find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. When it comes to World War II, there are a few dates that trigger instant association. If I say December 7th, you say Pearl Harbor. We're a few weeks away from May 8th, which will be the 80th anniversary of VE Day. And in August, the same story for VJ Day. But if I say April 9th, most of us have no idea. But there were some very moving ceremonies in quite a few places this past week on April 9th, otherwise known as National Former Prisoner of War Recognition Day. Congress established that designation in 1988, but why was April 9th chosen? Because that was the day 10,000 Americans and 65,000 Filipinos were forced to surrender to Japanese forces on the Bataan Peninsula, leading to the most infamous death march of all time. No U.S. state had more men on the march than New Mexico, and if you ever visit the Land of Enchantment, put Bataan Memorial Park in Albuquerque and the Bataan Death March statue and walkway in Las Cruces on your list. Julio Barella of the 200th Coast Artillery was one of 1,800 New Mexicans who had no idea what they were about to be facing back on April 9th, 1942.
We didn't surrender until we ran out of everything. We were starving, eating weeds and stuff like that in order to survive. And there's where the Death March started.
Now, when you started that march, you had no idea how long it was going to go, and you're already starving, right?
We started at Death March pretty weak. We were pretty weak then because when we were fighting, we didn't have enough to eat. First thing, we were getting only two meals a day, and then they cut us to one meal a day. And then after that, we didn't have anything to eat. So,
what kept you going? How did you continue on? Because I'm sure a lot of guys were falling by the side and probably getting shot or bayoneted, and you were seeing guys fall left and right. What kept you going? How do you think you survived?
To survive? Well, we used to hunt. We used to eat weeds and stuff like that. Then a lot of them died with malaria, and a lot of them with diarrhea, according to what they eat, see. And part of them died in the death march, and then the other part died in the concentration camp.
Did you ever think that you were going to die?
I thought I was going to die, but I just got to where I didn't care. It was just like this. See, I used to worry a lot about my folks, about my mother. I used to worry every day. And one day I said to myself, "Why, hell, I'm nothing but a doggone stupid. I'm not going to worry about them because they're better off than I am. They're not having as much trouble as I am having." And the other boys, they feel the same way. We got to where we forgot all about our folks and about the living life. Maybe we were just lucky because during the surrender, a lot of them died of starvation. A lot of them, they didn't have anything to eat. They were weak, malaria, dysentery and all that, a lot of disease. Well, we got to where we didn't care. We used to help the ones that couldn't walk by the Japanese. The ones that couldn't walk, they shoot them. When a man lay down and he can't get up, why, they shoot him. So if they were punish you when you were in concentration camp, they punished me and they knocked me down. And then I have in mind that if I try to stand up and get up, I won't be killed. So, see, that's a lesson the hard way.
I'll say that's a great way to put it, learning the hard way indeed. And every survivor of the death march that I've interviewed over the years has told me really the same thing that you just did. No one knows exactly how many people died on the march. I've seen estimates of around 10,000 or so. And who knows how many died later because of what they went through on the march. But I know that you Americans helped each other, and you got a lot of help from the Filipinos, who, from what I've seen, statistically outnumbered Americans on the march about 7-1. But all of you were not only marching 61 miles through deep layers of dust, you really didn't have any kind of nourishment. How bad was it? How bad in terms of what you had to eat and drink?
They make us wait 3 days before they could start giving us a bowl of rice, just how much they can grab on a bowl of rice. And that's when the death march starts. They start walking without water. And then in concentration camps, we were there starving all the time that we were in prison camp. We never did get anything much to eat. And they were Filipinos. They would try to help us, give us food. They find out that Filipino tried to help POWs. They would shoot them, burn their kids, burn their homes. They act like they were not civilized. We never have a dream that we was going to survive. We didn't, never thought we was going to make it.
Do you remember how much you weighed before?
I weighed about 145, 150. I never been very heavy. But when I was liberated, I weighed 83 pounds.
Your liberation. You survived the march to Camp O'Donnell. You'd been in another infamous camp at Cabanatuan. They took you over to Japan on a hell ship. And in late August of 1945, the atomic bombs had been dropped. The war was coming to an end. And finally, your camp at Niigata, Japan, was liberated. What do you remember about that? What do you remember about tasting freedom again for the first time in more than 3.5 years?
We're very, very weak. Our mind was very weak, and our bodies very weak. We couldn't hardly do much work. We just hope and pray that someday the war will be over. We were working in a foundry. They never gave us a day off, so we noticed that it was a surprise to us. So the Japanese said that we were going to get 3 days off, that we have to stay in camp. So we were anxious to hear the Japanese commander telling us that we have surrendered. And the American officer asked the Japanese, what happened? Nothing. You people won the war. The war is over. Now you people take over tonight. What the Japanese told the American commander, you take care of your prisoners, not to go out because they're going to get killed, because the Japanese don't like the American prisoners, and they're going to get killed if they go out of the camp. So better stay in the camp, so we stay there, you know, until the next day. Then the next day, they go three planes, and they drop us leaflets, saying that if we would clear the area, they will drop packages.
So they dropped some leaflets. They said, get out of the way. We don't want to kill you with the food we want to drop for you. And then you finally got to go outside of the walls of that camp. You'd been living in, I would imagine, and you have described what would be a bleak, seemingly hopeless world for so long, only praying that you'd make it out alive. So not to be too cliched, but did it feel like a dream come true or a prayer answered when you got to come home? What did that feel like?
Well, we had plenty to eat. Every place we go, we just give us something to eat and stuff like that. And it was pretty hard to tell the whole story about it. And I don't know. And some people, the prisoners of war I have talked to, they feel the same way that I feel. They didn't want to talk about it. They got to where they didn't want to talk about it. That's funny. We do more talking now than we did before. We never did say anything because everywhere we go, we start asking us how many Japanese did we kill and all that. None.
Let me ask you this. How often do you think about the other prisoners of war who didn't get to come home? Do you ever think about that, about all the guys who died over there?
I dream more about them than I dream about my people. Even today, Every day I remember some of the prisoners.
Do you ever think that could have been you? Do you ever think about that? You know, how you could have died there?
Yeah, surprises me that I made it. I sometimes don't even believe it. Being so long and I've getting old and all that, I sometimes don't believe it. I don't believe it. I went through all of that.
That was Julio Barella from New Mexico and the 200th Coast Artillery. Another unit that was in the wrong place at the wrong time in April of 1942 was the 194th Tank Battalion. Company A was a National Guard unit from Brainerd, Minnesota. Company B from St. Joseph, Missouri. And Company C from Salinas, California. First Sergeant Ben Ciccone was in charge of 123 men in Company C. After the death march and the years of captivity, Ben was one of only 47 of those 123 who survived.
At first, when I come home, I had nothing else to talk to but a prison camp, you know, going 5 years. And then after a while, people started looking at me kind of funny. And my brother said, I wasn't talking much anymore. I said, well, everybody looks at me though I'm lying or something. And I just didn't care about talking about it. But a lot of days I don't remember what happened on a march. And I say I was a survivor. And one of the longest, too, by the way, where I was caught. You see, that's why you read in history. They say 55, 60 miles. Well, hell, I went over 100 miles, and it took me 13 days. Because on the wrong side of the island, I had my platoon. We were supposed to counterattack and then cut across and get on the easy road back. But I started back. The Japanese had artillery set up there. So I had no choice but to back up. When I got there, they started the march. I was on the tail end. That's why I was 13 days. Wow. It was most of them 5, 7, 8 days. And if I could have crossed the island, then I'd have been a lot better. And along the march, I don't know how many days we were on it, but he got us all out. He put us out in the field. Well, in comes a sharp. See, he graduates from the University of California, or Southern California. Born, raised here. He called us every dirty, rotten name. Some I didn't even know about. Made us take our hats off and sit out in that sun with no water and nothing for about 8, 9 hours. And he called us every dirty name. Well, we lost 10,000 men on the march and dead all over the place. But as far as food, we had a rice ball along the way. But you're talking about 2 weeks. I had another buddy, and we couldn't go any further, so we fell out. But lucky, I don't know how long I was there, 2 or 3 days. And finally, some guy striking telephone wire, and he hit us, and of course, the jack to get the hell out of him, back in the highway again. So we had to go. We got in the highway, waiting for the stragglers, and couldn't find out. It was only a couple of miles where we ended up, but there was about 50. And when we got in this place with a number of maggots and dead people, next morning, there was only 8 alive, and the rest were just dead. The last stop, we took a break. We were just dead tired. We were off the road, and there was a Filipino. I gave him a little water, but he died. So we flopped down, and then they said the Jap guards were covered up. So we just stayed there and played dead. Thank God the guy next to me was dead. They just hit us with a rifle and just kept on going.
What happened after that?
We finally got up and joined the trek again. You had to get it on the road. If they caught you, they would kill you.
And thousands upon thousands died, whether that way or otherwise. In fact, an accurate estimate of just how many died is still elusive because of the way it all unfolded. But you're facing the prospect of dying from starvation or from exhaustion, by cruelty at the hand of your captors, and in all likelihood, you're never going to see your wife and kids again.
My wife waited 3 years before she even knew I was alive. My wife had to go to work. I had 2 children and a grandmother living with her. So my wife, lucky she's a college graduate, she got a job, and then she worked in theater at nights, and then she done some waitress work on Saturday night. She went to the Army. You know, I haven't got any money. My husband's as a prisoner of war. You know, or no, he's missing an accident. Well, we got to have something from your husband. You know, what a silly thing to tell my wife. So she had to go home with nobody giving nothing. Took her 8 months before she got a dime. The Japanese put out a propaganda that I was being held. Then she heard the official word was just a month before I was liberated. I wasn't liberated, I liberated myself.
And we want to hear about the liberation, but before we get to that, I understand you were 174 pounds when you got to the Philippines, that on the march you got down to about half of that. But one of the things that helped you gain back a little bit of that weight after the march is that you actually befriended some of your captors?
I made friends. Matter of fact, my life was saved by this Nagano-san up there. I went to Japan to see him. And if it wasn't for him, like I tell you, in May, it took most of my men I could find. It took us 3 hours to walk about 100 yards to get on this truck. If you get on the truck, you'd go into detail. And they took about 300 of us. Then the next day we went on. They stopped the convoy. 150 went on ahead. And 150 others stayed in this little town of Kalawan. And lucky, there's where we had a Japanese captain, professor at the University of Tokyo, spoke English. And he gives a talk that told us we fought a good war, we had to obey his laws, and there was no other way. And he would take care of us, or feed us, till we could go to war. He called in doctors, had the fellows bring us meat and food. We didn't have to do anything for 2 weeks if it wasn't for him. And then I got the job working in the kitchen, and this Nagano-san, the one up there, took a liking to me. He took care of me like I was a baby, I guess. Gave me sugar, smokes, and everything. So for 2 weeks, we didn't do anything. And if it wasn't for that, we'd all die.
So
now, let me tell you the rest. The 150 that went above us, only 8 survived that. We were lucky, that whole group, that 150 of us. We lost 7, and they would have died anyway. They were too sick to start with. But if it wasn't for them, and like I say, that Nagano-san, he helped save all our lives there, not only me. Then the story goes on for years.
Yeah, and you actually went and found him in Japan 8 years after the war and thanked him?
When I found out he was alive, we went to Tokyo. And I were at the Imperial Hotel. When I got downstairs, right in the early part of the evening, I spotted him with the stuff in his hands. He spotted me, put our arms around each other and cried. In Japan now, that's something else.
Even in the darkest situations, there are glimmers of light. That was Bataan Death March survivor Ben Ciccone. It's time for our first break. But this special episode in honor of National Former Prisoner of War Recognition Day will bring us the memories of two more ex-POWs. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode in honor of National Former Prisoner of War Recognition Day. We've heard from Bataan Death March survivors from New Mexico and California. Bud Kirchhoff was from Illinois. He joined the National Guard in 1936 and was sent to the Philippines right around Thanksgiving in 1941. For him, December 7th wasn't necessarily Pearl Harbor Day because that wasn't the only place Imperial Japan attacked.
Well, we got bombed the same day. Clark Field was a mess. You know, all the planes were landed and they were sitting ducks.
Sitting ducks, yeah. Destroyed.
Mm-hmm. Then they had dive bombers behind the high-level bombers, and I was only 100 yards from Clark Field when it was bombed, so we were vulnerable, especially in the dive bombers, which were also strafing and things like that. So,
what did that feel like? What went through your mind when you saw these planes coming in and everything's blowing up in front of your eyes?
Well, I don't know that you could say you think. You just react. You just do what you have to do. What happened was that right after the bombing took place, place, but not right after, but a few days later, they had a landing party at Lingayen Gulf. That's where the Japanese landed. And our group went up there. I wasn't in that particular action because I was on detached service to the MPs. And so when they finally got back there, then I left the MPs. I didn't need them anymore. And I got back in the tank again. But that was where the actual land fighting started, was Lingayen Gulf. And they moved gradually back to where we all that could get there were in Bataan, and that's where the peninsula of Bataan, and that's where we retreated to. And we defended there for, April 9th we surrendered. So I think 4 months that we were actually in combat mode.
How intense was that? Did you spend most of that inside a tank? Or where
good,
were you?
Good part of it, yeah.
Did that make you feel fairly safe, or did you feel like you were a target?
Actually, they aren't safe. Mm-hmm. they're nothing safe but a tank, because they're the first objects of their try to destroy, see. So a jungle is no place for tank warfare, let me tell you. So we were kind of hamstrung in the tank warfare and the infantry. So then, April 9th, we surrendered, and I got a little story. I was still in my tank when we surrendered.
Uh-huh. Did you know that was coming? Did you have a pretty good idea that this was going to happen?
We knew that we were surrendered. We weren't really, what do you call it? Anyway, we surrendered as a whole entity,
right?
A whole group, which is different than just surrendering as an individual or group, small group. So they had us burn our tanks, the butt plates off the guns, and open the gas tanks. And we had aircraft engine fuel in there, so, it burned in a hurry. Anyway, we all got in this truck, and we were going back to where we were getting together anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody didn't tell the Japanese that we had surrendered. So here come two Zero fighters strafing, and you never saw a truck empty so fast in all your life.
Holy cow.
Yeah, they were straight. I don't know anybody. I didn't get hit. I guess a couple of them got hit. So then I didn't go back to that truck again. I wandered through the woods until I got to our group. So we're sitting alongside the road, and the major in charge of maintenance came along and said, "Hey, you guys want to come with me?" And I said, "Where are you going?" He said, "We're going back to the maintenance department and get some clothing and canteens, and if there's any food, we'll bring it back." So I went with him, another fellow. There were three of us. So there's a beautiful blue Buick, about a 1939 or 1947. So we took all the stuff that we had collected and put it in the trunk and in the back seat. And we're driving back, and I was driving, and all of a sudden a little got out in front of us, and he stopped. And so he said, "Follow me," or didn't say it. He just motioned.
Mm-hmm.
So we wandered over under a huge tree that must have been an 8-foot trunk or 10-foot trunk of the tree, and it was like a house under there with heavy branches were 10, 15 feet wide on each side. Under this tree is sitting a guy in a beautiful white uniform. It was a general.
A Japanese general. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so we figured we're dead ducks. We were stealing their stuff because they owned it now that we were surrendered to him. All that guy wanted was the car. And I don't blame him. He's a general. He's right to entitled to a private vehicle.
Brand new, nice-looking American car.
Oh, yeah, it was.
Yeah.
So anyway, we figured we were going to get shot for sure. But only when we had to take all this stuff out of this car and carry it back to where we were stationed on the wrong side of the road. So that was one of those things that was funny, but it could have been deadly. So the worst part about the death march was the debilitating effects of the lack of food for the last 4 months, small amounts of food that we had, and just being in the Philippines. Now, like I say, we were only there for 18 days before the war started, so we weren't even acclimated to the difference between being in Chicago and being in Manila. There had been a directive come down to fight to the end, and this general who surrendered us, General King, said he wasn't going to do that, and so he surrendered us to the Japanese, and that's, of course, when they moved us out of Bataan into Camp O'Donnell. More men died in the Camp O'Donnell than they did on the march, and the reason for that, by then, their reserves strength had been exhausted to a point where they were too vulnerable to everything, any disease. I got diphtheria, among other things. Diphtheria is a dangerous thing. It's very high temperature and stuff like that. So And I was the last one in the group to get a toxin antitoxin, which is what you fight diphtheria with, see, so it was touch and go there for a while. I went to Japan in 1943, Omuta, which is the Fukuoka area, and we're coal mining.
So you were on the Bataan Death March, then you're in two different camps in the Philippines and three more camps in Japan, and you had entered the service, a strapping young Chicago boy of 200 pounds?
About 210. Anyway.
210. After the march, how much did you weigh?
Well, at the end of the march, when I had the pneumonia, I was about 100 pounds, a little under 100 pounds. Didn't quite get to the 100 mark. But then by the end of the war, I was up to 128.
What kept you going through all that? Was it the interaction with your fellow prisoners? Was it a faith that grounded you? What kept you focused on someday this is going to be over? Because 3.5 years, that's a lot of days to try to keep hope alive and stay positive.
Well, I didn't have a philosophy, as you know, but I did, but I didn't know it. And I just did one day at a time. Just worried about that day because yesterday was gone and tomorrow ain't here yet. So I had the philosophy, if you want, of taking it one day at a time. And the fellows who didn't, that worried about what's going to happen and think about home and everything, they're the ones that didn't make it, see.
But after all this time, 3.5 years as a prisoner of war, you've survived the march, you've been moved through 5 different prison camps, no end in sight. Finally, there is an end in sight. Talk to me about when you were liberated and when you knew that that was going to happen and what it felt like when you said, I'm a free man again. It's been a while.
Right near the end of the war, we start to get glimmerings that it's happening, see. And we're sitting out in the sun. It was lunchtime. And a B-29, we didn't know what it was. It was a big airplane. It went floating by. Mm-hmm. And what they were doing is taking pictures. So they dropped into our camp a map showing where all the prison camps were on this map. So they knew where they were. Mm-hmm. In fact, we had that one camp I was in. The city that was next to it was blown out by the firebombing.
But they spared the camp because they knew where you were.
But they didn't hit the powerhouse, the electric, you know, where they make electricity. Mm-hmm. Because we were right next to it, and they didn't hit the power plant.
That's where you're thankful for good intelligence, huh?
Yeah.
Because there were a lot of people that were on the other side of that equation. Collateral damage because the target was too important.
Yeah. Well, the firebombing in Japan, they keep bringing up the atomic bomb and how bad it was and everything. It was chump change compared to the firebombing. Man, it burned down a whole city with their firebombs and no warning like they did with the atomic bomb. They say, we're going to drop an atomic bomb, get out of the way. There was no warning with the firebombing, and the firebombing is much more deadly than the atomic bomb was.
And thankfully, they missed you guys. Then you find out, August of 1945.
August of 45.
After the second bomb was dropped?
Yeah. And like I say, I was only 40 miles from Nagasaki when they dropped that second bomb. In fact, the camp I was in, actually, I had a very weird experience, or unusual, maybe is a better word. After we were freed, they said, I came into camp, said, you're now free to go home and leave everything behind you don't need, and stuff like that, because they were dropping food and stuff to us.
Did it seem kind of too good to be true at that point? Like you thought that day would never come?
No, you know what? I thought, it's about time. That's all I thought.
Yeah, I guess so.
So we're in this camp, and this one is up in the mountainous area. There were two other guys. I said, let's go wander around Japan and see if we can find another camp and stuff like that. So we started to go out to camp, and a British major who was in charge of the camp said, hey, where are you guys going? We're leaving. He said, I'm in charge of this camp. You got to stay here. Well, we told them in no uncertain terms that we're leaving anyway. So I and these two other fellows wander around Japan for a whole month. And we'd go from some prison camps. Some nights we'd stay right in town, lay out, sleep around the public square. We got hungry, we'd go to another camp, and they'd have some food. And we spent a whole month wandering around Japan.
I want to hear what it felt like when you got back to the States.
We landed in Seattle. I flew from Okinawa to Clark Field, which we had left a few months ago. before that.
You had been there when it got bombed by the Japanese December 7th. Okay.
So then we were on a passenger ship from India, and we arrived in Seattle October the 27th of 1945, exactly 4 years to the day that I left from San Francisco. When I got off the ship, I never really got all excited. In fact, they put us in a hospital train and took us to Clinton, Iowa, Schick General Hospital there, and that's where we did our rehabilitation.
When your family saw you, did they recognize you?
Oh, well, yeah, but because by that time, I hate to say this, but I had gained about 100 pounds by the time I saw
you. Take it away, I'm bringing it right back. There you go. The number one thing that your experience as a POW taught you, what are you most thankful for from that entire experience that maybe has impacted the rest of your life?
Not to raise your expectations too high in life. Be who you are and don't try to be somebody else like too many people do. They try to extend themselves and are disappointed. And they, when I came back, I just got a job, went to work, and never paid much attention to it anymore. I had no flashbacks or things like that. I just, some of the guys did, couldn't, in fact, they couldn't even handle coming back home. Mm-hmm. It never bothered me a bit.
The late Bud Kirchhoff, Bataan Death March survivor. We sure look at freedom a little differently when we hear from those who know what it's like to lose it, don't we? Another powerful POW story is waiting on the other side of this break. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to this special edition of Hometown Heroes. If you missed National Former Prisoner of War Recognition Day this week, we're giving you a chance to reflect on the value of freedom by hearing the memories of men who faced a very uncertain future in World War II. Bill Overmyer narrowly avoided the Bataan Death March, but was captured on the nearby island Fort Hughes and taken from there to Corregidor in what was called the 92nd Garage.
And just day by day, if the Japanese gave us orders, we did it. If they didn't give orders, we just sat down and worried about food and water. We got the 92nd Garage. Well, one of my buddies, it was the one that I was best man at his wedding. He had some GI rations. I said, "Where'd you get that?" He said, "Right over there. It's such and such 92nd Garage." And I was as hungry as I could be. I hadn't eaten for 2 or 3 days. And I stood and looked at him, and he just kept eating. And finally I said, "Well, I hope the hell you choke to death." He didn't offer me a thing. Hmm. Our friendship ended right there. We separated. I never saw him again.
He ended up at China, a big camp there that had about 2,000. One day the camp was bombed by American bombers, B-29s, that came over. One of the bombers bombed, hung up in the rack. They got over the prison camp, which was not far away, and the bomb came loose and went down, blew up, hit him, and just filled his lower body with shrapnel, and he didn't live a couple more days. That was the end of him. And getting back to 92nd Garage, I finally got guts enough to go over and steal some of our own GI rations. They had an area on the island of you could go, and it was leftover stuff like blankets and shaving kits and all that kind of stuff that the Japs had taken from the soldiers. Well, I got a marine blanket. I thought, well, I don't know where we're going to end up, but I'm going to take this marine blanket. And I got a shaving kit, a Schick injector shaving kit that was laying there. I picked it up. It's in the medicine cabinet right now.
You still have it?
I still have it. I brought it back to where I was sleeping, and this other guy, he was there. Anyway, I went and got some cans of GI, had left it there while I'd gone over to get this blanket. I came back, and he was eating the darn cans. I said, that's the last time you're going to eat my food. And I separated from him. So I was all alone. And we finally got on a ship, got on at 92nd Garage, went to Manila, got on a train, and they took us up in the northern part of Luzon to a prison camp called Kamanatawan Camp 3. This was the Fortified Islands personnel. And I heard one officer say, well, we've got 6,000 men in this camp. So that's how many soldiers were captured in the Fortified Islands.
Mm-hmm.
Had nothing to do with Bataan and that deal. We were there until one day a Jap soldier came by and said, what did you do in civilian life? He addressed the whole camp. I finally wrote down, I said, carpenter. I had worked for Dad. I'd poured concrete. I'd hammered nails. Dad built some FHA GI houses here in Albuquerque, two batches of them, and I knew how to hammer nails. That's about all I knew. So I put down carpenter. I wasn't doing too good in college, so I didn't put down student. They wouldn't want to hear that. That note carried me all the way to Yokohama, Japan. And I went to work after we got to Japan. We walked 30 minutes every day from Yokohama to Mitsubishi Shipyard, worked 10, 12 hours daylight to dark, and back 30 minutes past the Yokohama train station, they made me what they call a toretsuke. That's Japanese for carpenter.
Mm-hmm.
A ship's carpenter. Now, a ship's carpenter does a little bit different thing than wood carpenters. But I learned, and they trained me, and I looked at the blueprints one day, and it said U.S. of A. Again, they bought all their stuff, their steel, their blueprints, their method of building ships, battleships, everything they had. They were copying what we had done.
And what kinds of things were you doing? What were you working on?
I was working primarily out on the decks. The decks were flat on the ground. There were steel plates. There were hundreds of feet of steel plates laid flat on the dirt. They would take a 40-foot long beam and lay it down on a new steel plate, and then use U-clamps on top of that and a wedge, drive that wedge in there and make the steel beam and the steel plate tight like this.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had some Korean kids about 10 years old that were welders. They all wore yellow uniforms and they were prisoners of war like we were. And they would come with electric welding and they would tack weld that steel plate to that steel beam. And eventually that steel beam would end up on the ship. We worked on one ship. It was a tanker, an oil tanker. And it came in. We worked on it for over a year.
Wow.
Converting it to a small aircraft carrier. Then when we finished our work, they put it in the water, and it was right alongside the dock, tied to the docks. We walked to work one day and heard some explosions going on and planes flying, and man, we couldn't wait to get over to the shipyard and see what was happening. Six SB-2Cs, Navy dive bombers, came in at sea level, rolled over, and sunk that ship right there at the harbor, and it was going glub glub when we got there. Boy, we were yelling, I'll tell you. The Japs didn't kill any of us, but we were happy.
It's the one time in your life you were really glad that some of your work was destroyed, huh?
Right.
Right. Well, and along those lines, I'm sure a lot of folks at home are listening to this and wondering what that's like when you're working every day, and it sounds like pretty exhausting work. I'm sure they fed you just enough to keep you strong enough to do the work, and I'm sure you weren't treated luxuriously or anything, but you're doing this work day after day after day, and I'm sure there's something in the back of your head that says, I'm doing this, and this is going to be used against my country, my buddies, my military. Was that hard to deal with, and did you ever try to think, boy, is there somehow I could sabotage this somehow or do something to compromise the integrity of what it is we're working on here?
We had to face that every day. We had 300 men in our prison camp. We had 17 nationalities. But some of the guys were on different crews. I was a Torditske. I worked one-on-one with the honcho. And some of the guys were welders, and some of them were riveters, four-man riveters. I remember hearing several guys say, well, I dropped the rivet gun today, and it went into the water, and I don't think they're going to find it. He was bragging on it. Mm-hmm. I don't blame him. That's good. We're supposed to do that. But if you're going to die, if you get caught, that's not so good.
That was my next question. Did you ever have a very real example or sense or understanding of what might happen to you if you were caught intentionally messing up the work that you were supposed to be doing?
Yes. I saw a couple guys that were, I don't know what happened at the shipyard, but they brought them back to the camp, and they put them in a little tiny thing. It was about as big a square as this, or even smaller. One man would be in there. They couldn't sit down. They couldn't lay down. They had to stand up. They couldn't stand straight up. They were bent over like this, and they were in there for weeks. Mm. Weeks. And we'd have snow at night, and they didn't have anything to keep them warm. Too bad. Too bad. In fact, toward the end of the war, I had a narrow point of view in some respects about how to do the work. And I'd tell them, well, talk to my honcho, and I'd say, let's don't do it this way. Let's do it this way. Turn it over this way and try it and do it this way. And it's so much easier. Nai, nai, nai. No, no, Jirosha, nai. Baquero. And you're not, we're not going to do that. We're going to do it the Japanese way. And if we don't do it that way, we're going to die. And it's the way they did it. Mm-hmm. They would die if they couldn't do it. One day, my honcho took me to the main honcho. He tried to talk to me, and I said, nai, nai, let's turn it over. And that set him off. Fujiyama was his name. And he came at me with a cold chisel. Now, they use cold chisels to write on the deck. And they use a chalk to write out things. And this blows up on the deck. And put it with such and such and so on and so forth. American writers would tell them what to do. Mm-hmm. And then they would use this cold chisel, and they'd write that same thing and dent it into the metal.
Right.
Well, this big honcho, he had gotten the word from the little honcho about me not wanting to do it the right way.
Mm-hmm.
So he came at me, and it surprised me. He tried to stab me with his Colt scissors. It was sharp. It got over my shoulder and broke the back, and broke the skin. It wasn't very bad, but it was enough to break the skin. So I just reached up and grabbed his hands. He looked at me, and I looked at him, and finally I just turned him loose, and he backed up a little bit, and I said to myself, Bill, you've gone too far. And here came a guy that was over there on the deck. He was about 100 yards off. He heard all the talking going on. I didn't understand the Japanese, but he did. He came over, and he slugged me right in the face, knocked me down, and it didn't hurt me that much. I finally just got up and stood there again. They turned around and walked away.
Mm.
They had saved face. And I never realized that that would happen. I didn't know what was going to happen. I thought I was going to get it all. But I didn't. They released me, and I went back to work the next day, and everything was all right. One day, we was on the Yama party, and the guard came to us and said, Bakadan, Toksan. Bakadan, Toksan. We said, Bakadan, well, that's a bomber. And Toksan is big. Yeah, that's pretty big. Must have been a blockbuster. We didn't know what the hell he was talking about. And until we were recaptured, we found out about atomic bombs. And it was the atomic bomb. Mm-hmm. What it was.
I'm sure. How was it that you were liberated? And what was that glorious day like for you?
Well, we had the same problem eating what little there was to eat at this prison camp. One day after work, the commandant, who was, we found out that he was a principal at the high school.
Huh.
And he spoke a little English.
Uh-huh.
And we went into the mess hall. Just the officers and the non-commissioned officers. And he got up in front, he said, peace is smiling. We said, what'd you say? Peace is smiling, goo. The war is over, goo. Hallelujah. That place went up in smoke. He said, don't tell the men. Keep it quiet, please. We said, yes, we will. Until we got out the door, and we told everybody else as quick as we could.
How do you keep that news to yourself, right?
Anyway, then here came B-29s. What the heck are they doing this close? Oh, they're dropping parachutes. Oh, that's a 55-gallon drum. Oh, it dropped right in the rice field right outside our camp, a camp of 55 drums of cocoa, 55 drums of sugar, lard, anything else. And, boy, we started eating like you can't believe. And I slept next to Cy Serrata. He was in the 31st Infantry at Yokohama. Right, I could touch him every night on a straw mattress. He had gone with us, of course. He was up on a roof. One of those 55 guns hit him on the head.
Oh.
Survived 3 years, and he got, at least he didn't suffer.
Here they're dropping supplies to try to keep you alive, and it kills him on the roof.
The chute didn't open.
Wow.
That didn't happen very often, but it did happen.
How tragic.
But it did happen. One other thing.
Yeah.
When our ship landed in San Francisco, several of the guys looked at the beautiful white houses along the shore and said, you know, the United States didn't even know that we were in a war. They didn't suffer. Well, I know better now. I know they worked. Ladies worked at making things and all kinds of effort. But to see a house that never received a bomb or any machine gunning or anything else, you don't really know what the war is all about.
We have a feeling now, though, don't we? And hopefully, we will never take our freedom for granted. That was the late Bill Overmyer. The ex-POWs we heard from today are no longer with us, but their stories remain to educate us, to warn us, and most of all, to do what National Former Prisoner of War Recognition Day is designed for, to help us remember and not forget. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you of those four words that the men we heard from today understood at a deeper level than we ever could. Freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.